In today's episode, we are joined by Dr. Dupe Burgess, founder and CEO of Bloomful, a platform that helps women take ownership over their health. In this episode, Dupe tells us about how she came up with the idea for Bloomful. She'll share her motivations for joining Incubate's programs. She'll also tell us about some of her mistakes that she's made in hiring and fundraising and what she learned from those experiences. I asked Dupe about her experiences of being a mother and a founder, and Dupe shares her top tips for balancing the two. Welcome, Dupe. It's so nice to have you here with us. I've got lots of questions in store for you.
Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me on. I'm really excited to have this chat with you.
We're going to be exploring your startup journey today. It's going to be very helpful for anybody that's at early stages of starting their startup. I'd like to begin by asking you a little bit about yourself. So what is your personality like? How would you describe yourself?
Oh, how would I describe myself? Complex, not a straightforward question, I would say. I think there's definitely different layers to what makes me. I actually did a post about this on LinkedIn earlier this week about different facets of my personality and how that has played into my startup journey. I think I am someone that is naturally quite an introvert in some ways. I'm not someone that likes to put themselves out there a huge amount. I'm not somebody that sells themselves a lot. And at the same time, I do present as an extrovert. So I think there's a bit of a dichotomy there that people are sometimes surprised about. I'm someone that likes to fly under the radar a little bit, and being around a lot of people a lot of time, I can find quite exhausting. And that's been something that I've had to definitely battle with on this startup journey a little bit. But overall, I'd say I'm very calm, quite poised as a person. I'm someone that is very curious, hardworking, very mission-driven. So I'm someone that likes to do things that I think are needed in the world. And I've sampled, as a part of my career where I don't feel like I was doing enough on the mission-led side. And that's kind of why I came back into the startup world. But yeah, I would say calm, poised, hardworking. That probably sums me up fairly well. Confident, engaging, curious, and hopefully friendly and kind as well.
Mm. I can see how some of those would also play into your early stages of your career. You started your career in medicine. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what drove you to pursue this path, which is normally a lifelong path as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I come from a medical family. My dad is a doctor. He has been a doctor for 50 odd years now. So I was always around that anyway. And I'm Nigerian by background. So there are lots of other doctors in my family too. I grew up in the home county. So I grew up in Bedfordshire in suburbia, white suburbia. And I went to all girls private school. I think being in that environment, and I'm very privileged to have had the education that I did, you realise that, you know, most people are moving in the direction of engineering or law, dentistry, medicine. And so you sort of latch on, even if it's subconsciously, to one of those types of careers. Nothing ever really jumped out of me in terms of what I wanted to do with my life. But being around in that environment and around medicine through my dad, I think it just felt like the lowest hanging fruit at the time. I've always been a very capable student. So I had the chemistry, the biology, the maths at A level. And I thought, you know, why not? One thing that did draw me to it was the idea of having that sort of lifelong knowledge and stability that does come with having a vocational career like medicine. And being a Black woman in the UK, I felt it would be a good move to at least have something under my belt that no one can take away from you once you have it. So it was definitely not the wrong choice for me to go into medicine. I think that on reflection, I would say there could have been a bit more dissecting of what are the indicators that this is going to be the right career for any person, let alone me. I don't think I necessarily interrogated that perhaps as much as I could have done. I just evolved. And I think that was part of it as well. I was I was quite conservative in some ways at that time. But as I got older, I definitely became a bit more, I guess, liberal in my thinking and a bit more of a risk taker. And that's where the decision to leave medicine came in.
Oh, and what was that like? It's a serious decision to make, right? Because it's so much commitment up front as well to the career path. And you mentioned that your family are also in medicine. Can you tell us a little bit about that decision?
So very multi-layered, very multifactorial. It wasn't one event that tipped me over the edge to leave. I think one thing to say is being a medic is a privilege. Being a doctor is a very privileged position. It's great to, at such a young age, have people trust in you so much, be involved in people's lives to such an extent. And I will never regret taking that path. I think it got to the point where I started to, as I say, just look at the world around me and think about how I want to position myself in the world. And I realized that I actually felt quite restricted in some ways in medicine. I became very curious. What else is going on? How does the world work? I felt like medicine was a bit of a bubble that wasn't allowing me to explore that side of my curiosity in a way. It got to a point where I was actually quite disillusioned. I felt quite restricted. And on top of that, working in the NHS, it's a difficult environment to work in. You often feel quite undervalued. You feel underappreciated sometimes. I think all of that stuff together, I experienced what I now know to be something like burnout. I knew then that I needed to think seriously about what I wanted to do. I was looking at some of my colleagues that were a bit further along and thinking, I don't really want to live that life. And then I met my husband, now husband, at the time boyfriend, and I remember just having this outsider almost coming in and having a very fresh view on me and how I was. I remember he would have to push me out the door to go and do my night shift on a Saturday night. And he said to me, "You don't seem very happy. Have you ever thought about sort of leaving and doing something else?" And I was like, leaving? I mean, I'm a medic. Like, this is my identity. But it was just refreshing to have someone else look from the outside and say, there are opportunities to do things with the skills that you've developed. They are transferable. You don't need to be stuck in one vocation just because that's what you trained in. And I just started to look at it more as I have a bachelor's degree like anyone else, and you can do things outside of what that immediate degree enables you to do. And so I did a lot of soul searching. I locumed for a while and I looked around and did a lot of research. And yeah, I landed in consulting as being the next step for me. It was a difficult process to get your head around the idea of leaving. I always think it's probably how somebody from the army or from the military feels about leaving the military. It becomes part of your DNA and it can be difficult to extract yourself.
Yes, of course. Can you tell us about what some of the challenges that might have been during that time? For example, maybe with your family. And the reason I'm asking is that I think there might be other listeners who potentially are sitting on the fence. I think your experience will help them.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one. I think the way that I dealt with it was honestly not necessarily how everyone else would, but for me, it was best to keep it to myself. I knew I wanted to leave, but I didn't talk about it that much. And it was partly because I didn't really want anyone's unsolicited advice about it. I didn't want any opinions. I didn't want to feel judged. But also, I actually did feel quite a level of almost embarrassment or shame about wanting to leave. This was at a time when not many people were leaving medicine. It was before things like strikes. It was at a time when, like you say, it was a job that you would do lifelong. I'm not saying it was decades ago, it was about 10 years ago, but still, I don't think it was the norm at that point for medics to even feel like they could leave. So I definitely felt a level of sort of embarrassment and shame around it. And so I did keep it to myself. And how I dealt with it was by selecting a few close confidants around me. So one was my boyfriend, one was my brother, and just talking to them about it and getting their thoughts. And then doing my own research and finally identifying what that next step would look like for me. And only when I got a job in consulting did I actually go to my dad and say, I'm leaving medicine. Well, sit down, first of all. I'm leaving medicine, but I have a job in consulting. There was only a sort of flicker of you're leaving medicine. And then it was, oh, but you've got this other job. So you've obviously figured out what you want to do and you're not being reckless with things. And as soon as he got on the internet and searched BCG and saw that this is a very reputable firm and one of the top consulting firms in the world. So there was none of that worry from my parents' side as much. Also, my dad being a doctor is interesting because I think he really gets it. He really got or understood motivation might be for someone like me to leave. He's always loved it, but I think he probably recognizes that it's not necessarily for everyone, and choosing something at the age of 16, 17, by the time you get to 30, it may just not be for you. I think people just need to be very strong in their conviction, very careful about who they speak to, and do as much due diligence and as much research as they can on what they want to do next.
How was your journey working at a major management consulting firm?
It was interesting, yeah. So I think I did put BCG on a pedestal somewhat. If I was going to move into consulting, I wanted to make sure that I was at a firm that was reputable and like felt like it was a sideways jump for me rather than a downward jump. That was just my personal thing. And I do think I put it on a pedestal quite a lot, to the point where when I joined, I was quite overwhelmed with the imposter syndrome. It didn't help that I worked out of the London office, which is very central London. It's just behind Selfridges in central London. And when I joined, there's 400 consultants working in the office, and I was the only black female consultant out of 400. Coming from the NHS, where it's extremely multicultural, multifaceted in terms of who's working there, diverse. The NHS has its own issues with who is at the top and who has decision-making power and who's the clinical director. Obviously, there are issues there with diversity, but I never walked into hospital and felt I was the only one of anything. So I think that did play on me a little bit. And I was also expecting my first child at that time too. So there was quite a few different emotions happening. There was a lot of getting used to just not wearing scrubs to work, actually wearing proper clothes and getting used to how you would talk to clients. It's a very different culture. I would say I learned a lot from working in consulting. It was a great next step for me after medicine. I learned about problem solving, how to build hypotheses and prove and disprove them. I learned a lot about how to present myself. I learned for the first time that my communication style is actually something that people were putting as a positive, which it's not something I'd ever really thought about before, but that was highlighted as being something that I was strong at. So that was really good to double down on that. I would say it wasn't the working environment for me forever, and I knew that I needed to just take what I needed to take from it and use that.
Yeah. Where along in this journey did you get this bug to explore the startup world and become a founder?
I think it was after 3 years of BCG. You do a lot of client work, strategy consulting, you're using data to help companies solve their biggest business problems, and that can be across lots of different industries. I did a lot of healthcare strategy, and that, I guess, brought me back around to health in terms of how to solve problems in healthcare. And I felt like I wanted to leave and just do something that I felt was more meaningful and more impactful to people, get back to doing something that would help people on a one-to-one basis, but doing it in a way that's more scalable. And for me, entrepreneurship just felt like a really, really logical next step. To be honest, after I left BCG, I knew I didn't want to work for anyone ever again in my life. It was the right time for me to figure out how to build something of my own. It was by no means a deep process, thinking process for me. It felt like the logical next step in the journey. And at that point, I'd identified a problem area that I knew I could stick with, and I knew I had the passion to drive forward and try to solve. COVID was also at this point, that's sort of when COVID kicked off. So it just felt like the right next step in the journey.
You made the decision to join some incubator programs. Can you tell us more about these programs, what your journey there was like?
Yeah. So the first one I did was Antler. And the reason I chose Antler was because it had a reputation as being obviously a good incubator. It was becoming more global at that time. I think they had one in Asia and one elsewhere. And the course was around how to pull together founders to create co-founding teams. So the idea was that you would be put in a room as one of 70 people with other people that wanted to build businesses at that particular time and start up businesses as well. And the idea was that you would almost go out and amongst those 70 people, find your co-founder or build a co-founding team. And that really appealed to me because, you know, you hear this rhetoric about needing a co-founder or ideally having a co-founder when you're beginning a startup. So it was just good for me, I think, to put myself in the startup ecosystem in that way and start to be around other people that were in the same phase of life as I was. It was the first time I'd learned anything or had put together a pitch deck, for example, or ideas around amongst us and pulled together pitch decks and things like that. And it was the first time I'd really sat in a room with other people that would wanting to build a business, and we're also on that journey of figuring out, you know, what problem, what's the solution, what's the market size, and then what a go-to-market strategy might look like. All of those things, I think it was really good practice, and it was for that. What it didn't give me in the end was a co-founder. You find someone that wants to build the same type of business in the same industry and has a complementary skill set to you. There was a few other people there who were into healthcare, but they had the same profile in many ways as I did. They essentially wasn't able to pair with another technical co-founder. Came the sticking point there. I was one of many, many people who didn't. But it was a really good experience. And I moved from there from that year to Forward Partners program, which was a smaller program, just one evening a week. But again, that was where I kind of zoned in on women's health specifically. Before, it had been more just about healthcare and what problem areas there are. In Forward Partners, I zoned in a bit more on women's health, and that's where the concept for Bloomful actually was incubated in a way. At this point, I just had my second child, and I remember this program was like a week or two after she was born. Good, because I was at home and things like that. But that was sort of first time that I was really starting to zone in on what Bloomfield could do and what that business could look like, and building a deck specifically for Bloomfield in preparation for starting to speak to potential investors the following year. So yeah, I think these incubators are good for getting yourself into the sort of startup mindset, learning more about the ecosystem, starting to build out your value proposition, starting to get pitch ready or investor ready if that's what you're looking for, and starting to make connections.
To set people's expectations. Like, what did the programs not give you?
Difficult one. I was very early in the journey, so I was really grateful for the information I had. I mean, I don't think you can necessarily expect to come out of an incubator or an accelerator, with everything sorted for you, your idea completely conceptualized, your pitch deck perfectly done. One thing I've learned about this process is you need to see it as a journey. It's not a A to B, let me just get to my destination and I'm done. It's a completely evolving and iterative process over the course of time. That incubator or accelerator is just the very, very beginning. It's just the first bus stop on the ride. And I think if you see it like that, then you perhaps shouldn't necessarily go into it expecting anything beyond what you get. As long as you get some knowledge that you didn't have before, some connections that you didn't have before, I think that's a good outcome. Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to talking about Bloomfield then. I would love to hear the story of Bloomfield from when you had your idea up to where it is now.
Yeah. Okay. So year 2020, there was a lot of discussion around inequality. It was obviously the year that COVID kicked off, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter movement, lots of discussion around who gets what, how and when, equity, equality. And I think I really immersed myself in some of those discussions. And being a doctor specifically, and with COVID happening around us, I was very interested in who it affects most and how and why. And I think it made me really question some of the things I had actually seen in clinical practice, especially around women and women's health. And there was talk about how the COVID vaccines were affecting women's menstrual cycles and things like that. I think I started to gather quite a lot of literature and just dive into why do these issues exist for women where they don't exist for other people within our population? And what's the reason why we don't have answers to things like how a vaccine affects the menstrual cycle? That to me seems crazy. So that was probably the first nugget of curiosity that made me look back into my own clinical practice and think about times where there had been women coming in general practice, for example, with problems, issues, gynecological health issues, bleeding, pain, and always seeming to be chasing their tail for an answer, always seeming to be having to come back time after time, speak to somebody else and try and get to the bottom of things and not really getting anywhere. And when you dive deeper or scratch the surface, you realise that there is a huge, huge problem in our health system with, well, gender inequity, essentially. It's a system which historically has been built for and by white men. Healthcare in general was built with one population type of person in mind. And it's been extrapolated to everybody else from there. And so what we're left with is a situation where women haven't been involved in clinical research for as long as they should have been. Only in 1993 was it mandatory for women to take part in clinical research. So 1993 to me, I'm not particularly old, but it doesn't seem that long ago.
And it's recent.
Yeah, it's pretty recent. And so there's so much catching up to do. And today, less than 2.5% of medical research goes into women's gynecological health and reproductive health. So when you think about the population that needs that research and the amount that goes into it, there's such a big disparity there. We have issues around pain and how our pain gets acknowledged by the medical profession. We have issues around how women are often dismissed and not listened to. Symptoms are minimized, how that reflects on workplace practices, how employers are managing their female employees and what space they give for women to really be able to share these problems. So it really permeates so many different parts of our lives. And I just started to really understand that aspect of things. And that's why I wanted to start the business. And so we started by developing a platform where people could literally book in on demand with a doctor, with a gynecologist for a remote consultation. We were delivering blood tests at home. We were partnering with clinics if women needed ultrasounds, for example, and trying to deliver the full end-to-end journey as digitally as we could, essentially. And the idea being that we know that not everyone can afford private healthcare. We know that it's very geography dependent. It's dependent on income and how much disposable income people have and how much they're able to pay. And we also know that in the NHS, there are huge bottlenecks and so many issues with waiting lists now. So that was the idea, to make it more accessible. What we found is that it's very difficult to commercialise that model. People are not used to paying for their healthcare in the UK. It's really hard to drive any kind of B2C revenue by getting people to pay for this. So then we moved on to developing software, a tool that would help women to, it would use conditional logic and clinical reasoning, and there's an algorithm that sat behind it, and it would enable women to punch in a bunch of symptoms, their kind of profile, and get an indication of what the likely or potential diagnoses could be, or differential diagnoses could be. So you've said you've got this, this is perhaps what you might have. Lots of people used it. We had thousands upon thousands of people using that tool. But again, hard to monetize, hard to flip people into our digital clinic. So it's been a journey of discovery. We've also explored the workplace, how we can package things for as a benefit for female employees. But where we are really now is working on the B2B side. So we've been through all the models and we're now B2B working with clinicians and working with doctors to really improve their delivery of gynecological care. And the way that we're doing it is by finding a way to aggregate women's symptoms in a much better way, and not only their symptoms at any one time, but the progression of those symptoms over time. As well as that, collecting things like quality of life data. So how are your symptoms actually affecting you? Because that's really what women care about. How is it affecting you? What's it doing for your ability to work, your mental health? And bringing all of that information into one place and presenting it to the doctor such that they can use that to actually drive their clinical decision making. The reason that we wanted to do it this way is because a lot of what doctors are offering to women is essentially guesswork. They don't really know which HRT is going to be best for you. They might give you one that they've got available to them or the cheapest one. Same with contraception. How do we know whether those medications are really having an impact or whether it's something else that has made your symptoms better or worse? So just trying to really standardize and objectively view all of this information in one place and enabling doctors to use that to drive their decision making. Our software is in prototype phase and we're working with doctors to develop it. Yeah, it's a very exciting time and there's a lot more work to do on it, but we're getting really good feedback.
Incredible. I really loved hearing about your iterations of how you moved from having bookings with gynecologists and then moving through the different stages. I would really love to hear about behind the scenes of what's going on with actually building a tech product.
Yeah, so just on your previous point, I think that's something that I hadn't really appreciated before when I started this journey. And I think it's something that people should really bear in mind when you're building a product. What you start with, all the thinking that you have right at that beginning stage, is very, very unlikely to be what you end up with. What we have now may not be what we end up with. I think it's important to realize that it really is an iterative process. The winner, if you like, is the person that's able to really stick with it and show resilience and grit and just keep going and keep listening to customers, looking at data and evolving towards where you need it to be. To your question about how to build a product. So I think one thing to say, and this is one mistake I made right at the beginning, which was I'd had so much feedback from people about the need for a tech person on the team that the minute I had angel investment or outside investment, that was one of the first hires I went to make. I need to get an engineer. But at that time, I didn't actually know what we were building, how we were building it, why we're building it. I didn't really have a really solid grasp of what type of engineer we need and why. And so I hired one and he was a lovely guy, but we realized a few things almost immediately after we hired him, which was that first of all, we can actually do a lot without a single line of code by using no code tools, which now there are thousands of them available and you can do a lot towards building at least an MVP or a prototype without having to code anything. So I had this full-time engineer sitting there dabbling with these no-code tools, and I'm thinking, what you're doing, I could do, or someone else on the team could do. So that was a real lesson to me. Really think about who you're hiring and why, and don't hire just because you assume that that's the way it should be. We ended up letting him go, and I felt really bad about that, but it's part of the learning process. We have a small team. It's very small. There's four of us altogether, two of whom have been with me since the very, very beginning of, well, the first time I hired. One does operations and the other does more on the content branding and kind of communication side. So anything that's outward facing, customer facing, she deals with. I think it's very important to say that whilst they have their titles, the crux of it is that everybody needs to be able to do everything. At this stage in the business, you need people that can think as well as do, not just do, if that makes sense. You need people that can think laterally, bring things to the table, ideas, do things that I haven't even thought of before I've even thought of them. Everybody needs to be able to muck in to some extent. And that's something that's very unique to this very early stage of a business. If you have people that require 10 people around them to enable them to do their job, they're not someone that's going to be suitable for this early stage in a founder's life. They need too much infrastructure that you can't afford. As simple as that. But it's much more important to look for people that are able to turn their hands to lots of things than people that are very specifically on one thing and only on that thing, and only if they've got A, B, C, D, and E in place. Our team is great at that. I could not be more grateful for Leah and Eleni, who work with me every day. They're also just both very, very driven by this mission and are very bullish on the need for technology in this space. Our fourth person is Luke, who does engineering on a part-time basis with us. He's someone that came on a few months ago, and he's great as well. Very driven, very logical in how he thinks about things, but also able to give ideas and contribute in that way as well.
Sounds like you're making lots of progress. I'd love to turn our attention to your funding journey. This is a huge area. We know that women are massively underfunded. So I'd be really grateful if you could share your journey. And more specifically, I think I'd like to also start the story with what point in your journey were you when you started fundraising?
Okay, so I think that's a very good question to start with, because I started way too early on reflection. These are all the things I'm able to see looking back. At the time, it felt like the right thing to do. So what I did was I thought to myself, okay, if I can just get like a few signups, that should be enough to warrant going out and pitching people, or at least having something to start the discussions off. I think there's two sides to the coin. In some way, it's good to start getting yourself out there if investment is something that you think you're going to need for your business, and starting to build relationships and talk to people, because I think that's one misconception, which is that you speak to an investor, they like you, and they just put money through. Of course, it can happen like that, but I think more likely is that you build a relationship with someone over the course of time. You keep them informed of how the business is going, you give them updates. It's a process that takes time. And so I think it was good in some ways that I started having those conversations early. However, I wasn't ready for investment really at the time that I went out. We had a long waiting list of people that wanted to use this product, but I think we hadn't really, when I say we, I mean I, hadn't really figured out or solidified things like our go-to-market strategy, how we were going to get our first users in volume and then scale from there. That was an issue. So I think that's the first thing, because the problem is with the other thing to say is that talking to investors and things, it takes a lot of time and energy, and it takes you away from actually doing the business. So it is important to strategize like when you plan to do that, if you do. So that's the first thing. So I spent about a year on and off talking to investors of all different types. And that was another thing. I didn't really zone in on what specific type of investor I felt we needed. If you are looking for investment, you need to really think about what type of investor, because they're not all created equal. You've got angel investors, you've got angel syndicates, you've got family offices, you have micro funds, the bigger funds, you've got grants. There's so many different types of investment, and I didn't strategize whatsoever, really, not enough on what type I was looking for. So it can end up with lots of time wasted if you're not careful. So think about that too. Eventually in 2022, we did raise a small round of funding from angel investors. So all of the funding we've had so far has been from angels, varying ticket sizes, but it's actually been really nice to have individuals that are committing to backing us, because you feel more connected to them. Often they introduce you to other angel investors. I think the relationship is a little bit more intimate, if you like. You're not having to knock on the door of a big VC firm, and you feel like people are invested in you. So I've definitely got some wonderful angels, and I would advocate for trying to raise some angels if you can get away with it only. And on that note, I think the other thing is this idea that you even need investment in the first place. I think times have changed. The landscape is very difficult. It's very difficult to raise now, especially in this sort of economic climate. So I think it's very important for entrepreneurs to think clearly about whether they need investment. If I was to start again, I would say the best thing to do would be to try and bootstrap as much as you can. Try and build a business in as sustainable a way as you can that actually delivers revenue from day one. And you'd be surprised how far you can get, I think, if you do that. And then, of course, you end up giving less of your business away. You end up maintaining more control over it. And you're not necessarily reliant on outside investment to at least get that first growth phase under your belt. So I think it's good that people are less interested perhaps in investment overall, and bootstrapping is becoming a much more accepted way of building a business. But yeah, hopefully that's given a few things to think about in this and in the fundraising journey.
Yes, definitely. Were there any challenges that you faced when you were going to see these investors?
Yeah, I think one thing that would come up, especially in the early days, was just like with co-founder thing. I think it's less of an issue now because we have raised money. But I think I would get asked quite a lot about where the co-founder is or what the rest of the team. And it can be quite hard to gather people at that early stage. That's one thing. And you have to be very strong in your conviction that actually I'm a doctor, I don't need a co-founder necessarily, or this is my plan for getting people on board. There's ways around it. You can have advisors, technical advisors and things. So there are things to say. I think otherwise, it's just a numbers game and just the endurance that you need to get through that process. It's not an easy kind of sprint. It's not a quick textbook, it's going to take me 3 weeks to close this round. I think most people now definitely are taking months, if not a year, to close their rounds. And that can be difficult in terms of challenges to keep the momentum going, and to keep your spirits up and to stay positive about it and to stay organized and just stay motivated really throughout that process, especially because, as I said, it takes you away from actually building the business. So yeah, co-founder, the length of the journey. I think most women at the moment definitely will agree that there are challenges around the perception of women when you're in these kind of meetings. Sometimes you get asked inappropriate questions, and you have to understand or figure out how to field those and maintain your purpose in those meetings and stay focused on what you've come in there to get. Also not being afraid of shutting down a meeting or moving away from a situation that makes you feel uncomfortable or is not appropriate. So I think there are certain challenges that certainly certain people have to think about where others don't. I think I would say talking to as many people as you can who have been through this journey is a good way to just get a sense of what it's likely to be like and to prepare yourself as much as possible.
Fantastic. How has this journey changed you?
I don't know if I've necessarily changed per se. I think
developed might be a better word to use.
Yeah, I think I've definitely become much more aware of the part that resilience and grit plays in this. I think perhaps if you'd asked me 2-3 years ago, I would have said it's a very structured process. You're going from A to Z and you just have to go through all the stops. Now I realise that it's a very kind of long and iterative journey being a founder. And you've got to find a way to get through that journey, number one. But number two, maintain a sense of self and enjoy it to some degree. So I think how I've developed is really optimising for just resilience and being that person that can have a growth mindset in everything that I do. So rather than seeing when things don't go right, rather than seeing it in a negative light, trying to just take away that small morsel of learning from it and using that to drive forward. I think this is completely a learning process from start to finish. Everything about being an entrepreneur is about what you're learning and how you're learning and how you're applying that learning going forward. So I think that growth mindset is something you subconsciously cultivate and it molds itself out of what you're doing. I think staying focused on the right path is another thing that I've had to like really zone in on. Going back again 1 or 2 years perhaps, you get the shiny object syndrome. Things come up that perhaps aren't actually moving the needle for you. And I think there's something about what I've learned is every single thing that you do, is this getting you that step closer to your goals? Asking yourself whether it's something that is helping you drive towards what you're trying to achieve. Because sometimes things may come across like they are, but when you actually really think about it, you're like, not really. So actually, are you better placed using your time elsewhere? And on that note, I think time management and just being able to say yes or no to things, not feeling obliged to say yes to every single opportunity, especially if it doesn't move the needle, and really taking care of your own time, that's something that I've had to get very sharp on doing. Just not being afraid to say no if it's not something that's going to serve what I'm doing. And I think finally, I think just enjoying the journey and realizing how privileged I am as a person to do it. I'm very well supported. My husband's great. He has stuck by me through thick and thin, been the shoulders to cry on. Not everybody has a lot of support around them in many different dimensions, not just people, but also money and all that stability and everything. It's a very privileged opportunity, I always think, to even be able to build something like this. I think just the acknowledgement, and that is the case. I always try and maintain that.
Yeah. On the time management topic, that leads me to another question, which is, what have you had to let go of in order to pursue a path as a founder?
What have I had to let go of? Oh, that's a good question. I think one thing I've had to let go of is perfection. I am somebody that likes to do things typically in a very structured, ordered way. I'm quite type A in my personality. And 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, my ideal state is to deliver things in their perfect form, something I've worked on for ages, really proud of it, giving it to the boss and saying, like, here it is. Are you pleased with my great work? And I think one thing I've had to let go of in this journey is the idea that anything can be perfect. I've said it before in this conversation, but it's a very iterative thing. And there is actually something about shipping things, getting things out in as imperfect a state as you can, so that you can get that feedback in real time and as quickly as possible. And then you could iterate on that rather than going off this perfect, so-called perfect path, and they're actually realizing that that's not what customers want, or that's not what your team needs, or whatever it might be. So yeah, letting go of the idea that everything can be perfect and moving more towards this kind of, let's get things out. Let's do good is better than perfect. Let's get it out and see what the feedback is. That's one thing. I think another thing is, honestly, and this is something I need to work on, is just time for myself. I am a mum. I am running a household here as well. So I definitely spend less time on myself than I perhaps did pre-startup. There's only so many hours in the day. I'm an organised person, but even with that, I feel like there's times you have to slice off your you time to give to other things, whether it be answering emails, responding to investors, dealing with the children, all of those things. So I'm not saying it's perfect, but I do think it's important to have that sort of self-care time, if you like. But yeah, that's something I've definitely had to reduce a little bit.
You mentioned motherhood, and it's a perfect segue into a question that I had for you. You are a mother of three. I wanted to ask you, because I think it would be very helpful for other mothers listening, what balancing the responsibilities of motherhood and being a founder have been like for you, and what have some of the struggles been, and how have you managed them?
I think it's been... everyone's journey on this is very different. And I think a lot of it boils down to your own personality type and how you are as a person anyway. And I think I'm lucky in so much as I was well positioned just from my natural personality for everything that comes with being a mother and an entrepreneur at the same time. One thing I will say is that I don't think that the two things are mutually exclusive at all. I think you can build a business whilst having a fulfilling sort of home life and being a good mum as well. I think it's just about, again, finding ways that work for you and figuring out how to get that balance. I'd say there's like a few key things that I would always advise when it comes to this. So the first is, it sounds kind of obvious, but just only having kids with someone that is really going to go in on that 50-50 with you. I think that's where some people do sort of fall down from the outset, perhaps. I think it's important to be on the same page when it comes to what kind of home life you envisage when you have kids, and just making sure that you're both aligned with what the vibe is going to be before you embark on motherhood, full stop. And as part of that, I think playing to your strengths as a couple is important as well. So my other half does all the cooking at home because I'm not into it. I do everything to do with the kids and keeping the house clean, all that kind of thing. So we definitely like move, only play within the areas that we are good at naturally. And I think that's part of it. It's just go with what you're good at. I think the second thing is also figuring out things that you just don't do. Like, I have a list of things that I don't do and I don't feel guilty about doing. For example, I don't do my nails. I just don't have time and I'm not bothered about it. Other people, that's important and that's really great. But unless I'm going on holiday, it doesn't figure in my kind of scheduling time. I don't volunteer at school. Not because I don't want to, it's because I don't have the time and I'm not going to feel guilty about it. I don't allow kids to have more than two extracurricular activities each. I say to my son, I know you want to play more football, but I don't have time. We're a family of five. And that's just what it is. So I kind of box everything like that in a way. And it means that I don't feel guilty. It means that I've already set the standard. We know what the benchmarks are. And it just is what it is. So I think that's the iron. That's another thing. Like, so the thing is just finding out what you do and don't do. And then I think the other thing is getting help, delegating, getting help as much as you are able to in your situation. Of course, everyone's situation is different, but if you can afford to outsource something like cleaning, do it. If you do have family nearby who are willing to help, allow them to help. I think there's something about just not trying to be a martyr about it and just using as much resource as you have available to you. And then the final thing I would say that I've been conscious to do is getting my kids as self-sufficient as possible, to be honest. I'm Nigerian by background, so this whole like gentle parenting thing, it's not for me personally. My job is to raise kids that are independent and know and will be able to leave the home and navigate the world and know how to do their washing and everything else and all the household stuff. And I do get them started on it very early. You know, in my house, it's a bit fun. I say, if you've got hands and you've got legs and you can make your own bed. You're seven, you can make your bed and you can fold your clothes and you can unpack your school bag. So I'm quite, I do make a thing of making sure that they do their bit, and it helps massively because it means that it's less for me to do and you're also teaching them to be self-sufficient. So I think those are the key things that I have actively done to make sure that this works. Just being organized and trying to get as much done in advance as possible is also just a general thing for life. But yeah, and it works for us. I think we've got a decent enough system going. It's not hard. It's a process, but we've got a system that works.
As we move into the conclusion of this session, I'd love to ask you, what are some of the three highlights from your journey so far?
The first highlight that comes to mind was being funded by Google. So in 2022, we won a grant from Google for Startups, their Black Founders Fund. That for me was a time where I was really trying to get validation for Bloomful as a business. And it was a really great moment for me to say, okay, there is actually a big kind of company, tech company out there that understands what we're trying to do and is willing to back us and put money towards us. It was such a great moment. I still remember getting on the call and getting the kind of nod that we had got that grant. And I actually cried. I was so happy that it was just such a relieving moment and a moment of validation for me. So I'd say that was definitely the first thing for me. Other positive times or times that stand out, I think hiring the team. Again, the idea that I was able to bring people on for this journey or inspire people enough to really understand our mission, our vision, and get them bought into it and bring them along for the journey. That's just a really nice feeling and a really nice thing. And also working with people that you really respect as well. That was a really nice milestone for me as a founder. And I'd say the final thing is just getting through really hard times. Like 2023 was a very difficult year for the tech industry, for entrepreneurship, for startups in general. And I saw lots of companies falling sort of by the wayside over the course of that time for various reasons, some of them very well funded. And you get to the end and think to yourself, gosh, we're still standing. I'm not saying that things are perfect. We have our own issues, of course. But I think I've reframed what success perhaps looks like in this industry from being like a unicorn that everyone needs to talk about through to just being able to build something sustainable that has impact on people, positive impact, and doing it in a sort of slow and steady way without running out of cash and building a culture around you that is good. That for me is success actually right now. And so that's been a really positive outcome and a really positive kind of thing that we've been able to enjoy the last year or so.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, all amazing highlights. What are you looking forward to in the coming year?
I think I'm just really looking forward to this new product that we're bringing out, working with doctors to really try and change the way that they manage these conditions, building a product that people love, that people want to keep coming back to, which not only improves how they are interacting with their patients on the ground, but also it will revolutionize the data around and the collection of data around these conditions so that we can make that actually usable for researchers and for pharma and to start to actually move the needle around women's health for the long term. I think this is going to be a very pivotal year for us as a business to reach that kind of product market fit on that front. And we're currently securing some amazing clinical champions that are really behind us and really understanding what we're doing and wanting to showcase us and push us forward. So, yeah, I think that's just what I'm looking forward to, continuing to work on what we're doing.
I absolutely love that what you're looking forward to is delivering the outcomes that you set out to achieve, which is something that's so important that, you know, founders wake up and they're actually looking forward to solving the problem that they're working on.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. There is nothing that motivates me more than actually making an impact on the ground in this specific area. So I love the fact that I get to do that every single day. I get to continue to push myself and challenge myself in that way every single day to work towards a solution that's going to really make that change. So this was definitely the right area for me to build a business in. And I generally look forward to it every day that I'm working on it. It's a real privilege.
Final question before we move into a little lightning round. What three tips would you give to founders that are getting started today?
I would say, firstly, make sure that you are prioritizing your passion. I think because it's going to be a long journey, it's really important that you really do what drives you, lean into what drives you as a person. And everyone's personal motivations are going to be very different. I'm mission driven, other people aren't. I'm never going to be the person that builds an Instagram, for example, because I don't feel like it, for me, provides that mission element. So really interrogate what drives you and lean into that. I think the second thing is really understand the type of business that you want to build. I think we get very stuck in this high growth tech startup realm, but there are so many different types of businesses. There's a lot of talk about solopreneurship and being a one-person business. There are lifestyle businesses. There are brick and mortar companies. There are tech companies. There are deep tech companies. So I think it's really a spectrum, and really when you any idea you have, really narrowing down what type of business you want to build, but also what kind of business this idea lends itself to, is very important, so that you get off on the right footing. I think the third thing is grow your network. Again, this does not come naturally to me, in so much as I can talk and I like being in front of people, but I'm probably one of those people that has to push myself that little bit more to get out there and really showcase what we're doing and myself as a person. But if you can do that as much as you can, whether it be going to events, virtual and in-person events, whether it be social media, using LinkedIn to find your tribe, find your people, find your champions, I think it can't be understated how important that is. The two team members that I work with regularly, they were both found through connections. Leia, for example, who does operations for us, was something like 3 degrees of separation away from me. So I met someone who then introduced me to someone who then introduced me to someone, and then I found her. So you really have to get yourself out there and start talking to people in your field so that you can leverage everybody around you. And on that note, I think I've mentioned it already, but it's very important to find your champions early, whether they be sponsors, advisors, whoever they might be. Find people who really understand what you're trying to build, who will help you to grow and evolve, and will be that voice that continues to push you forward and helps to showcase what you're doing to the rest of the world. And also realizing that those people might change as you grow and as you evolve. It might be that you've got an advisor 1 year, but the next year or a couple of years later, they're not quite the right advisor for you. So you will evolve, and the people around you will too. So yeah, I think those are my biggest tips for people that want to come into this.
Great, thank you. Some sound advice there. So I've got some fun questions, or hopefully you to conclude our session today. So I would love to know, what do your mornings and evenings look like?
That's such a good question. So my mornings, and bearing in mind that I've got 3 children, they are 7, 3, and 1, so they're still very little. My mornings are a little bit frantic, although they're not too bad. I'm up at 7:30. I'm up by 7:30. We have a 45-minute sprint to get everybody ready, get everybody fed, and get everyone in the car, and then off to nursery and to school and to drop my husband at the station. And then I come home and open my laptop and start work around 9. And my mornings, I try to keep for deep work. I try to keep my mornings as free as I can to just do work that requires brain capacity, if you know what I mean. So if I've got applications, grant applications, if I need to review content, if I need to work on the actual product, work on prototypes, I try and do that stuff early so that I can maximize that side of things. Obviously, I keep myself going with coffee, just like everyone else does, and all other mums do, I think. And often we will have sort of team meetings interspersed as well. So yeah, that's what my morning usually looks like. Hopefully that gives you a picture.
Yeah, definitely. And your evenings?
My evenings, kids home, get the kids bathed, get them to bed. They're in bed by 7. They have to be in bed by 7. And then I will usually open my laptop and do a bit of work, either in bed or on the sofa, I would just answer a few emails. And it's usually stuff that I will pinpoint as being stuff I can do in the evening, so it doesn't take as much brain power. So if I need to pay an invoice or, I don't know, do something like just reviewing things, or maybe there's something I've earmarked that I need to read through, I will do that in the evening when I don't need to be as sharp. And then the final thing I do before bed, say 10 o'clock, is I'll just go around the house and I'll make sure that everything is sorted for tomorrow. So literally, I go in the kitchen and I put all the cereals out. I put the cereals out on the table, bowls out, spoons out, everyone's shoes by the door, everyone's coats are by the door, bags are packed lunch, like everything is sorted, because I don't want to be madly scrambling in the morning. And then, yeah, I'll go to bed at sort of 10:30-ish, and that's me for the day.
Great. It's a relief to know that you're not going to bed at like 12 or 1 or 3.
No, I don't do that, because what happens is the next day I'm just not fresh. I wake up feeling really tired, and I just don't think that's a good cycle to get into. Don't get me wrong, I have had those times, and I'm not a huge morning person. I'm more of a night owl, but I've had to force myself to try and get the rest. And at the very latest, I'll be sort of lights out at sort of 11.
Okay. Great. Is there a resource that you've read on this journey that you would recommend to our listeners? It doesn't have to be a book, maybe like a book, a podcast, or a blog.
First thing to say, with a business and 3 kids, I'm not big on reading at the moment, to be honest. However, one book I do really like is Simon Sinek's Start With Why. Yeah, I really enjoyed that book. I read it on holiday last year, and I like him anyway. I think he's a cool guy. Loved the messaging in it. Really made me think about why I'm doing this. And I just think it's a great one to read for everybody that wants to go into business to read. It's a great starting point to think about your purpose. As far as podcasts go, so I have been listening to Daniel Priestley quite a lot recently. I don't know if Daniel Priestley, he is an Australian, he's in the UK, but he originally is an Australian business guy. He's built multi-million pound businesses across different domains. And I love the way he talks. He breaks things down so simply. And he did two podcasts recently. One was on Stephen Bartlett's Diary of a CEO podcast.
It's about the experimentation.
Yes, I can't remember the name of it, but I watched, it's one of the only podcasts I've actually listened to twice, or I actually watched it on YouTube twice, because I took a lot away from it. Really actionable, very structured way of thinking about business, and it really helps you to build a roadmap. And actually, not all of it is relevant for like high growth tech startup or whatever, but it's just the principles that he lays out I found really intriguing, and I took a lot away from it. And then he did another similar one with a guy called Ali Abdaal. His podcast is called Deep Dive with Ali Abdaal, and Daniel Priestley was on that one as well. Again, another great conversation.
We can link them here so that people can...
Yeah, do it. That one was called, it was like an entrepreneurship masterclass, how to go from $10,000 a month to like $100,000 a month or something like that. You'll find it on YouTube. But again, I really enjoyed the conversation. It just opens your eyes to what's possible and gives you like a roadmap of how to get there.
Great. And final question, how do you set yourself up for success on a daily basis?
I don't think there's anything I do specifically to set myself up for success, but I think for me, it's just around staying true to myself. I think doing work that I really believe in is, I've learned over the course of my career, the best way for me to get the most out of my day, my week, my month, and my career in general. It's the best way for me to stay engaged with what I'm doing and to really feel like I'm fulfilling what I'm capable of doing. So this is the most disjointed kind of career that I've done, in so much as there's no set pathway, but it's the happiest and the most fulfilled that I've been out of any of the jobs that I've done, where there's a very strong and well-trodden path, and or BCG, where it's a very well-known and glamorized sort of industry and firm to go to. But little old Bloomfall, where we've got a team of 4 and we're quite scrappy, is where I found the most joy, the most fulfillment. So I think on a broader scale, how I set myself up is by leaning into what is really true to me as a person, and going out and finding that.
Great answer. Thank you. It's been wonderful having you on here and diving into your journey. You've shared so many insights, and I'm sure this will be a great listen for our audience. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Can I plug my Substack and my LinkedIn?
Please do.
So I'm starting to share quite a lot more on LinkedIn in terms of the journey, building a startup, women's health, as well as motherhood and leadership. And it would be great for people to follow me on there. It's just Dupe Burgess, Dr. Dupe Burgess. And then I've also started a Substack recently, again, talking about the same types of things. I get lots of questions from women about how you do it all and wanting to share tips about motherhood and all of that. So I've dedicated my Substack space, which is dupeburgess.substack.com, whatever. I'll link it. You can link it.
Finally.
And yeah, that's where I do more longer form content around that topic. So yeah.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Cool. No worries.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast episode today, please do hit the subscribe button and share this episode with like-minded connections. I'd also like to take this opportunity to let you know that I'm sharing knowledge on how to build tech products. If this sounds like something that's going to be helpful to you, please subscribe to the She Files newsletter. The link will be in the show notes.